Conference record has joined the conference.
Let's figure out and see. We have an hour and 45 minutes. Right. We need to make sure that by 3 o'clock we're doing this section, right? So do like 15 minutes on the data, and then we'll spend an hour consolidating. Okay. Okay. Great. So this discussion is really that, like, let's do our categorizing.
Okay, how many?
We call for one.
3, 4, 5, 6.
You're going back on the train too, right?
Train.
10.
Oh my God. 4:15 train, so we had to get there, you know, before 4:15.
No.
We have to leave at, we have to leave here at 3:40. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so
running late coming, you know, from Canada, so we may want to check if they're running late.
Well, yeah, I want to. Yeah.
We'll
still have to be out.
Yes.
Still 3:30.
I know they run late sometimes. Okay, well, we're going to get started now.
I'll go ahead again. Dr. Burkhead with the State Health Department. And there are a set of slides in your handouts related to the data. I'm going to try to go through them quickly, do a high-level overview of what's there, and then Karen Westerveld is going to speak about the specific proposals that we've gleaned from the prior MRT discussions and also things that we've put together at the health department to give some background. So we've already begun the discussion of the data this morning, and a lot of good points were made. The intent of this presentation was to provide you with some of the data that we have within the health department and to get solicit your ideas for other data and other ways to look at the data. And I think we've heard very clearly this morning that we probably have better, more granular data on disparities within the department, that we need to look at data from OPWCD and from OMH, and also some of the Medicaid data that we've presented could be broken down by race, ethnicity. Those are all good points, and we just want to get your input into what other ways we should be looking at that. Just to highlight, there are many ways of looking at disparities, differences in health outcomes between groups that reflect social inequities, and we've been focusing, I think, a lot on racial ethnic, although we did hear gender and gender disparity as well as sexual orientation disparities. So if you could look at this geographically, I think many disparities also come down to socioeconomic differences as the underlying issue, not in all cases. And we have data on some of these, and we don't have data on others of them. Most of our health data I'm going to show you come from a few sources: Vital Records, SPARKS, which is hospital data, Medicaid data, and we have the Behavioral Risk Factor Survey is a telephone survey that looks at risk factors in the population. And those databases don't collect a lot of the things that you're interested in, I think, like sexual orientation, like primary language and other things.
They do collect disability, and you have that disability data.
So we will make an effort. Yeah, Dr.
I just want to ask one question. Do you have the ARC Hospital Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems, HCAHPS data? For New York, because that gets to the patient assessment.
That's a good question, and I don't
we
know,
find out
I know the
if
answer to that
if we
question.
Have access to that, we can get that. Okay, great, thanks.
So we've been looking at disparities mostly with our Office of Minority Health and Minority Health Council, and I just wanted to share with you some of the different ways to try and look at this and look at the magnitude of disparities. One way is to look at an index of disparities, which is sort of the difference in disease rates between different populations compared to the overall average rate. And that, I'll show you some of that. And then the other way is not to look at the rate, but the actual number of people affected. So you can have a very rare disease with a very high rate. You may decide to make that a priority and impact only a few number of people, whereas a smaller disparity of a large nature like heart disease or hypertension may end up impacting many more people. So you can kind of look at it in two ways. And these are the 10 areas that we have focused on within the State Health Department in our prevention agenda that we have broken diseases out. And we did add mental health and substance abuse. This is our work, the way we've organized the local health departments to look at their public health improvement plan as well. And whenever you do health planning at a local level, mental health and substance abuse come up. So even though the state health department doesn't cover those directly, we did include that in this. So this, if you look at the index of disparity, and that is comparing the rates in each, this is by racial and ethnic group, for disease, and then see where you have the biggest variation in rates of disease. This is what you see. It turns out that of the diseases and conditions that we looked at, tuberculosis had the widest variation in rates among racial ethnic groups, followed by HIV, followed by asthma. drug-related hospitalizations, infant mortality, colorectal cancer. So you can see that, these are the conditions that have the widest range. And down at the bottom, conditions with relatively lower differences in rates among different populations. So you look at who's seen a dentist in the past year, it's sort of score across all race and ethnic groups. So there's not so much disparity there. There may still be a health impact of the population, but in terms of focusing on the differences between race and ethnic groups, it's not there. And so this is an example of just what I was saying. The HIV case rate has a high index of disparity. The average difference in new HIV case rates for individual race and ethnic groups compared to the average rate is very high. Infant mortality is less, so the interpretation is that the disparity in the rate of the index of new cases of HIV is about twice the level that exists for infant mortality. And then you can go into each of these measures and see which racial ethnic group it is that's actually driving that difference. And, for example, the high disparity in tuberculosis rate is driven primarily by the Asian population, which has the highest, by far the highest tuberculosis rate. The other conditions you can see here, African-American, black African-American. And, again, these are very crude racial categories. We acknowledge that. It's reality, I think, though, that many of our databases don't have more details than that at this time. But that's certainly an area, as Dr. Buford said, where we can try to work to get the ACA data there. The other thing to say about race, ethnicity in most of these databases is that it's self-identified. That means it's not a provider writing it down for somebody. But even if it's self-identified, there's probably some variation in how people describe themselves. And particularly, I think the census has found that people have interesting interpretations of what they are if you try to pin them down on race, and it becomes a little bit difficult. Yeah.
And I think that you're sort of pointing to a central problem, which is there has to be a unanimity standard. Is it the OMB standard for classification? And how is the data collected? Is it the HRED recommendations? This is the IOM recommendations? Because if you collect it differently, then this is like nonsense.
Well, at the main databases that these are based on are, SPARC, Medicaid data, vital records, some of our communicable disease reporting. They're very simple race categories.
Right, but in terms of recommendations from the committee, I think that we have to look at how is the data collected and how is it reported? Because, in order to have comparability, et cetera. I'm not questioning what you have, I'm just saying that.
The next step.
I agree. Improving the data on where we have complete gap, like the sexual preference, we have no data on that in any system. And improving the collection in the systems that we do have, where we do have the data in important parts.
Right. You have disability data, so it would be good to regularly include that.
We'll go back and get that. So this is just indicating, the actual race, and so you can break it out by the population to see which racial ethnic group in this case are driving that disparity. The other way to look at it, as I mentioned, is sort of the total number of people impacted when you see differences. So, for example, binge drinking. If every racial ethnic group had the same binge drinking rate that the lowest group had, that would be almost a million fewer binge drinkers in the population. So that turns out to be, of the things we looked at, the disparity that had the largest difference. If everybody was reduced to the lowest binge drinking rate, you would prevent this much. And then there are other questions here, for example, percent of adults with health care coverage. If everybody had health care coverage at the rate of the highest covered group, almost half a million more people would have health care coverage. So this gives you another way of sort of prioritizing how you might choose to focus on different areas based on the number of people impacted rather than the different disease.
Okay.
A lot of the questions on this slide are from our behavioral risk factor survey, which looks at sort of the primary risk factors of disease rather than the outcomes of hospitalization or disease. Yes.
I'd like to suggest another filter also in looking at the data is by geography.
Geography, yeah.
I think certain other conditions will be highlighted.
Yeah. No, I think geography is one of those areas, and particularly I know people are interested in urban health, but also rural health is got to be a part of this, then that's a different challenge.
What are the groupings that we have for geographic, regional, or zip code? I mean, how does that work?
We have data often at the county level is the easiest to do. We can break it down to zip or census for some data. We have just home address. We can break it out by census tract. We geocode it. But a lot of our data, the finest level would be zip code. And so, for example, I know I work with the lead poisoning prevention program. We can hone in on those zip codes that have the highest lead poisoning in the urban inner city zip codes affecting primarily population. So we can break it out that way geographically as well. The general behavioral risk questions like smoking percentage and other things generally are not separate based on a random survey technique, so we can't break that to the zip level. Usually that's more at the county level. This is just a continuation of that list with a different scale at the bottom, these are the lower level things. So for things like early stage breast cancer, colorectal cancer, cervical cancer, we actually don't have very large disparities in terms of numbers. And then, just basically just to describe again that if all racial ethnic groups experience rates similar to the best performing groups, New York would prevent, these numbers of conditions.
I would just say that that's actually a very good example where having sexual orientation training this would probably get you
So this work group is going to have to consider lots of issues. I've presented just two, and we obviously can do many more cuts on the data, two ways of looking at the data, but so for the problems, vary the conditions. Are there evidence-based strategies to actually do something about it in the resource and infrastructure and sort of partners in the community? So we can go back and try to look. These are the general categories of data that we can look at. Access to care, risk behaviors, hospitalization, mortality. In each of those, we probably have a gap in terms of the types of data.
I think you should also include ambulatory care-sensitive conditions. Because the state has the PQI figures. I mean, it has the prevention quality indicators that ARC distributes, and those are based off sparse data, so they can be at least as correct as the sparse data could possibly be. But that's something that's an easy one that tells you a lot about the primary care in the community. It gives you kind of a neighborhood geographic cut at it, and something that looks at diabetes and heart failure and other things that are very prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Great. I just wanted to, do you also capture the population in the criminal justice system?
The population in the criminal justice system is generally not unless they get hospitalized and generate a spark. But we can't identify them in the data usually.
Thank you for asking that question. Isn't there a way from Department of Corrections?
Well, State Department of Corrections does have a electronic database, and we can try to approach them if that's an area of interest to the group. I'm not sure that MRT is going to impact that, but
those would be people that be flowing in.
Well, people are coming out of the system. Right. That's a very good point.
Just a correlate of that, I think there is a proposal to include Medicaid eligibility determination as part of discharge planning from jail and prison. I think that we didn't mention prisoners during this, but I think it's like
because
it does directly affect Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
No, actually, I haven't seen
that. And this again just breaks out for the group I just showed you, which racial ethnic group is driving the high rate in terms of number of persons impacted. So again, it's by our approved category, it's mostly in African American or Hispanic population.
So wait, go back to the page. I'm sorry, I was assuming the red was the
red is the worst for the health condition. So the lower the percent, prenatal care is the marker of the poor health condition. So 80, only 60% of black pregnant women get early prenatal care, whereas 70 to 80% of others. So, so it depends on whether you're framing it as a positive or a negative. The higher or the lower comes out. So again, if all racial and ethnic groups had equal the best performing group, New York State would prevent these many. So I actually think I'm going to stop there. There's a lot. There are a lot more slides here, looking at data, and I'll just highlight to you that we have broken this out even further on some tables to get at, you know, drill down. For example, on this slide, into the percent of adults with health care coverage, regular health care coverage, you've seen the dentist, et cetera, and which are the worst and best groups. So the short answer is we could tell you with a lot of data. I think it's going to be helpful to try and hone in on particular areas. So I think I'm going to actually stop there and ask Aaron maybe to come up on two. The rest of the slides in that set are just higher level detail.
MRT proposals. Is there any reason why it would be to our advantage to use existing proposals? And have these proposals been rated and scored at all?
Not to my knowledge. I'll have to check. But these are ones that I was told that predominantly either hadn't been considered or those that have been considered for whatever reason when MRT was moving forward chose not to move those forward.
Okay.
So it's really, I think, depending on what your areas of priority areas of focus are going to be,
yeah.
If these fall into those categories, then you may want to consider
just something that I think we're all aware of, but just for the record, as we go forward in our discussions, let it be noted that the HEDIS QAR measures, which is the state's primary way of measuring health in Medicaid, is not broken down by race, ethnicity, or language. So,
or disability.
So that let that be something that we can bring up later on in our discussions.
And the measures don't necessarily address all of the population issues as
very
well.
Complete. Yeah,
right.
Yes.
There are no disability-related measures. Okay.
So I have three sets of presentations here. And Lauren, you were very good this morning, and you identified the four buckets. And in the four buckets, you have behavioral health with 400,000 recipients, right? Okay. Then I see the presentation on health disparities that Gus just gave us. And there's sparkling of some indicator of disparities here, like suicide, for example. And then Karen just gave us the proposals for with the MRT. And it seems to me that this is not very integrated, because if you have 400,000 people that you identify in your first bucket, and then we don't have, and this committee is supposed to address disparities, and we don't have disparities here related. We only know a little bit of the health disparities, perhaps this group, but we don't have the health disparities. For example, we don't know, in terms of schizophrenia, and going back to the earlier discussion of indicators of population and gender and ethnicity.
Suicide and adolescent.
Suicide. I mean, we run one of the first suicide prevention program for Latin adolescents in New York State and the country. And I think it's absurd that 22% of adolescents who are Latinas in Brooklyn attempt suicide. And that means one out of five. And then I don't see that here. And if I look at depression among women in New York State, Latina women have the highest rate of depression compared to other populations. And just as starkly, but if our task is to reduce health disparities, and we have these priorities of buckets, how are we integrating this data? Because, you know, the three of you have presented, in a way, separate, parallel data or information, but it's not yet coordinated. And, you know, I know that we're meeting on September 16, which is the next meeting. Put aside the deadlines of the health homes and HBOs and whatever.
Could I interject here? I mean, the next little less than an hour, we'll be doing doing some real substantive discussion. And I mean, the purpose is really for us to get what you want out there and well defined. Now we have 36 statements of, and you know, in all fairness, not everybody made these statements thinking that this was going to be how we're going to use them. So there's obviously have a lot of input. But I would recommend that we move to the next and start talking and start, you know, really doing it in a straightforward way, laying out what we need to actually accomplish.
What I need, quite frankly, thank you for that, but what I need to make a little bit of sense of this is comprehensive data that includes chemical dependency and that includes mental health and, you know.
So I thought I heard Gus saying that he would procure the data from OMH Oasis to give us.
Yep.
And it would be really great, it seems to me, just to build on what you're saying, is if we got that data circulated well in advance of the next meeting so that we could inform.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I'm asking. Yeah.
Great. I have a little question, which is, you talked about the prevention agenda of New York State Department of Health.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how much, I don't know in depth about each of these areas.
Right.
I know that a lot of the areas that you have on your prevention agenda are key issues for people with disabilities. I went through it and could mark off virtually every single one as a top issue in the disability population related to disparities. But I don't know how the prevention agenda is being used to address disparities and whether there is some synergy between the things we might consider in terms of programming, policy, practice in all of the other areas and what's happening in this agenda. Does that make any sense?
It does, and disparities are a part of the integral part of the prevention agenda. On the, I think there's a web link there. We have listed evidence-based approaches, community partners, programs that the department funds in these areas.
So not, I would find what you're doing with respect to tobacco use by people with psychiatric disabilities.
Well, probably not at that level of detail. Probably not at that level of detail. It's a good point. The prevention agenda was primarily used for the purposes of counties doing their required municipal health service plans and hospitals doing their community service plans. And we picked these areas and asked them to work together on those planning efforts.
I raise it because if I look at what are our communities, what are our providers already focusing on, what is the Department of Health already focusing on, where are their resources committed, where are their strategies being employed, and if we were to look at all of that through the lens of the disparity issues that we're trying to raise, and then try and crosswalk that into initiatives like health phones or electronic data systems or data collection, all that, would we have an advantage? Would there be a way of looking at this?
It certainly is how we've engaged the local health departments to do their community public health improvement processes over the last couple of years. And hospitals have, and at the local level, we've encouraged joint planning with hospitals, health plans, other sectors. There hasn't been new funding put into it.
I see that.
We try to leverage existing as we do often to try to
harmonize as much as possible the approaches being taken as well, so that we're not
Okay, so we have Jackie.
I mean, just a quick question. Is there a limit to how many proposals we can make? Is there a budget?
But we're going to have to prioritize and make some decisions after we get stuff out there, I would say. Yeah. So, yeah, there is a limit, but we haven't set it.
Isn't that part of the consideration? You might want to prioritize differently based on some knowledge of some universe of overall funding that's available.
Right.
I would have certain priorities if there was $1 million and another priorities if there were $200 million, right?
Right. Yeah. Yep. And Dr.
Rupert? Sorry. We should also think about what the mechanisms are by which our recommendations can become enacted. So right now there's an immediate one. We heard that there's a health home proposal that's still sort of in draft. You used a different term. Still accepting recommendations or being tweaked. How's that? But if there are pieces that logically fit in of the ideas that we have, there's an opportunity now around that. But there's only so many mechanisms that are going to come out. Some of the MRT thing came out in legislation. I mean, I don't think, we're going to develop a list of 12 things and they're going to all end up in legislative language. So I think we should also look at what opportunities there are in terms of programs that are evolving for us to put our stamp on, as well as looking at the recommendations that others are making. I think we could make recommendations in relationship to some of these programs. For example, we're talking about health problems. We're worried about confusion of patients. What can be done to help clarify how they're being rolled out to the community so that people really understand what those entities are that they're going to be assigned to and how they work and all of that stuff. It's going to be a huge consideration because it took 10 years for people to realize that they couldn't just keep going to the eye doctor that they always went to and that their grandmother went to. And when managed care came in, and now we have a whole new entity that nobody's going to understand for another 10 years. So we have to figure out, that is a disparities issue, right? We have a real resource that's coming into our communities, which is care management, something we haven't really had access to the same extent, many of us. And how that resource gets implemented is really critical to improving the health of the people we're taking care of.
Joe.
I had a process question. Are you imagining, you mentioned, you sort of alluded to this at the beginning of the meeting, are you imagining sort of sub-clusters of people in this group working on issues? Because I'm just, between meetings, or is this kind of we give you our wisdom and advice and you go off and do the best you can with what you have. Because I'm just thinking that something like the health home might be a nice project for two or three people who are living, eating, breathing it to look at in regard to the disparities question. There might be a handful of others like that. And people, you know, most people, a lot of people do have staff that could put some
bring
that
in
if we had, you know, some connection. But I didn't know how you were planning to work.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a resource issue. And, you know, I think probably I would speculate that those, you know, the state, the folks who work for the state are busy supporting a lot of other processes. But if we could create our own infrastructure and use our own resources to do that, there might be something, some kind of overall sort of, maybe you guys could help in some sort of way to help us coordinate.
Can help to coordinate. I'm not sure we can schedule, you know, thousands of conference calls among the group.
Right.
If
we
the group
could
is able
that.
To
help organizing groups.
Organizing group, I think that would probably make the most sense. Yeah.
And perhaps if we can get to our, you know, the discussion of the actual the content area, then we can actually have a couple of groups that are tied to different kinds of content. And that way it would feel like we could continue the discussion after today's meeting's over and prep for the September 16th.
I comment
meeting.
On the medical home that you can, these comments I think are being registered and can go be fed back into the process now sort of informally. I'm not sure there's a mechanism for what the group wants to try and develop a quick recommendation. But the, I mean, technically the recommendations of this group go to full MRT to be included in whatever goes forward. So if there's a health home recommendation that goes longer term that you want to fit into that, that
could be a mini group
that would be
now,
great. But in terms of the ideas that
are
generated,
long,
we can turn it into
like 30 days.
And so that group on health homes would undertake to address the language issues and the disability issues.
Well, we'd look
well,
through the regs,
look at
see
it.
If there's
see if there's something you would want to add.
That's
in terms of disparities. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I am concerned that there's not that Office of Mental Health is not here. I'm concerned about that. I think that's a huge representative of care, especially if you're talking about health homes.
Well, this is we have very large committees that are working on health homes, and we're working very closely with the Office of Mental Health as well as OASIS and OPWG on somewhat of a different track.
This is not a health home committee. I totally appreciate the interest this committee has in health homes, but health homes is being worked on diligently by other work groups.
Yeah.
And we're working very closely with OMH.
That's okay with that, but I'm seeing here when it comes to disparities, and especially if we're talking about people who have mental health along with some type of chronic illness, I think it's very important that
together we can bring that material here to the table.
Yeah.
I don't think we need an OMH staffer here at the table.
But even just the material or data
what's
going on, you
know. And they're going to supply it, right?
I think we're getting a little off track, and time is of an essence because you guys have to get a train. But I do need to reiterate that I do not think adding two other staff people here from the state offices is going to make a big difference. We heard your concerns. You need data.
Yes.
We're going to go back, and they're going to work and see what we could do. We're going to try to get that data out before the next meeting so you have enough time to look at the data, evaluate, flush it out by the end of the next meeting. I mean, by the time we meet again, then you'll have other concerns or issues, and we'll try to address them. The idea to have this group was just that, to have input from the community, from people that do this on a day-to-day basis, not necessarily the state folks.
Because you're the experts. So you're here as a peer. You're representing. You have a very strong voice representing the recipients and so on and so forth. And we have community-based organizations, public hospital, private health, you know.
I think collectively we could all address those concerns. So I hope, you know, you feel comfortable that, you know, the concerns will be addressed. I need to stress the fact that health homes
And this happens in every single committee.
Yeah, it does. Health Home takes the licenses on, and I know it's the glue. It's the glue, you know? But remember, keep focused. Our primary focus is disparities. Let's not lose sight of that. And also, in our recommendations, address the concerns and the issues that we have around the Health Home initiative. But, you know, let's not lose sight of what we are charged with doing.
So I actually have a very concrete proposal. I feel like you're right. Health Home could eat up the whole conversation, and I don't think it's the sum of what we're here for. So my proposal would be that if there is a group of people around the table who want to self-organize around Health Home and looking at implications for disparities around that and bring back to this group then in September some concrete recommendations, that they be empowered to do that. And let's move on and talk about other areas that we'd like to focus on.
I really want to get into the piece where we, you know, identify what those other areas are, and then also just, I think about key ways in which, and maybe we can do this right after or through email later, but key ways in which we can, before the next meeting, have those discussions to bring concrete proposals back.
Well, I suggest that there's the Health Home group, and then there may be other self-organizing groups that want to form. When we've decided what they are, after the meeting, we'll send out an email to everybody, and you can just tell us who wants to sign up for which group, and then we'll send out a roster of each of the work groups, and you can self-organize.
Okay. So, you know, we didn't put this up on the list, but I think one critical piece that we could look at as another sort of self-organizing piece is the financial stability of the safety net. And I think that if we don't look at the financial stability of the safety net, we're going to be building a house on no foundation. While we're doing all of this stuff, there's a lot of, you know, mental health folks, case management folks, HHC, a fair number of our community health centers and others that are in really serious financial trouble. And while we're doing things around proposals, they're the folks that take care of the people that we're all worried about. And I think we need to look at, I know the data's been accumulated. I think, you know, and Hospital Fund did some and other people did some, New York State Health Foundation, but we should pull together the studies that have been done looking at the financial health of the safety net and see if it's not important to make some recommendations about that, because if that's undermined, we've got nothing to build on.
I think part of that will be some of the smaller recommendations around charity care and care for the uninsured
that
have to be a focus.
Well, that will fit in. It is one of your, don't freak out, it's one of,
it's,
yeah.
It's
part of the charges.
Yeah, it is.
So how are we going to deal with this? If you lose some of that capacity, you're losing often more accessible capacity than would exist in the community in its absence.
It's up there twice.
Okay, let's get going on the actual work. Agreed. Okay. So how are we going to do this process? We need to organize 36 items into probably four or five buckets.
A group that volunteers to organize those into categories.
These are just, I mean, it was an introduction, okay? Everybody just what's in your mind, okay? It was not a forethought and, you know, carefully crafted anything. I mean, so that is rather meaningless, I think. I think that not that this shouldn't be typed up and passed around, but I think that people could come up with more, you know, cogent recommendations.
Yeah, I know.
Unless there are some pearls of wisdom out there.
Okay, so the point was to either use your smart words if you thought of them that way, or come up with what you would have said if you knew we were doing it this way. I mean, I think there are some, you know.
I can tell you that over lunch, Jonathan Lang, because he had to leave, came over and chatted with me, and we had already decided that we were going to self-organize, and in lieu of public hearings, we were going to called together a focus group to look at disparities in the LGBT community and see if we could come up with some very concrete proposals to bring back to the group in that regard.
Excellent.
And if there are other people who would like to join us in doing that.
Well, they're going to do the organizing for you, so that's
well, well, if we can agree on what the groups are, we'll let people volunteer to be with whatever they want. So LGBT is another focus area.
And do we agree on the safety net?
Financing.
How are you defining safety net?
Thank you.
Providers who serve a majority of Medicaid and uninsured.
That has to be part of the discussion, right? There's no formalized definition.
No, there isn't.
So actually, before we do that, we Dr. Rupert had made two recommendations, and we didn't formally say like.
Okay.
Are they we're just assuming those are taken care of, and that
what.
We can ask the workers to charge the issue around the ACA data. I would volunteer. I mean, I would volunteer to be on a group that looked at the disparities impact assessment, just given what. Well, I mean, something that would could be used quickly based on what you have to have the other Medicaid teams have to. At least self-evaluate in that regard. And then I think the other is the data display that, you know, ideally things would start to get, all of them would start presenting their data against the ACA requirements, even if they're blanks, and that we would add sexual orientation to the gender issue there. But if you don't have it, they don't have it. But that's part of the recognition is that it's not there and it has to be found,
So the reason I if that is simply going forward as a recommendation of this group, and Gus is saying, yes, we will start working on that, then it sounds to me like we don't need to form any kind of work group on that.
We can work with them. I mean, my staff can work with them on that if anybody else wants to.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the extent that we can require other work groups to do anything. That may be beyond
our
remit.
We could certainly
provide a suggested approach to include disparities in whatever discussion is going on.
Okay, great.
And if people agree, we could also edit this charge to include those two points, and we'll send that around in draft for people to comment on after the
consensus.
Well, also I would just add that if there was a way for us to be able to filter information, I think there's models for impact assessments that are out there that might be helpful to you in looking through that. And similarly for data collection, I think there's some real questions about what some of the ACA proposed regulations are putting forward and ways we may want to tweak that. So I think if we can feed that information to the state and then maybe discuss concrete proposals the next time, that would be very helpful, and I'd be happy to help with that.
So it sounds like there is a sort of a disparities impact group that we could offer people to participate in.
Okay. Well, we're making it up. I mean, you've got health impact assessment technologies, but they sort of vary with wherever they're being done. So I think we can, You should come up with something, and then maybe the people that are interested could comment on it.
Okay, great. Okay, so let's keep this rolling.
Don't forget the safety net one up there.
Right.
So I guess the reason I interrupted before putting it up there was because somebody asked the question, what do you mean by safety net? And I was actually going to give you a concrete suggestion.
Start with that, and then you can.
We go through others and see if there's still a bucket left safety net.
I think that's too much editing on the part of the scribe.
I'm not the scribe. I'm at the table.
We're talking about an examining information on the financial stability of safety net providers. That's the financial stability of safety net providers.
Safety net providers' financial stability.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm wording it
backwards.
That's okay. As long as you get the words of this. It's all right.
Okay, so let's keep rolling.
You want a language access test.
So could I amend that to say immigrant and linguistic minority access?
I mean,
Yeah.
keep it simple.
Keep it simple.
Linguistic access.
Because in our case, the minority is the majority.
Right.
This seems like a kind of an awkward thing to do, but I guess you've got to put up a disability subgroup if we're all breaking down into subsets.
Disabilities is in all this. If
we,
it's there.
I would have thought so.
We would hope so that
are.
The disability would flow through all of
well,
that.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, think about what you're creating if you create subgroups for every one of them.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned.
So the purpose really here was to identify those things that are the highest priority going forward on our agenda. The priorities that we want to focus on. Not all of them have to have a subgroup, but some of them will. So,
for example, we could take these categories and organize these ideas plus all the ones on the table, do a summary for the group to consider, you know,
at
the next meeting.
Yeah.
We have a bunch of hands. Neil, and then, okay.
I think there were a whole bunch of things on there. I can't see that far, unfortunately, but on sort of the structural issues of the healthcare system and the way they maintain and support continued disparities in care. So differential access, issues around differential access, differential locale of differential payment, the things that basically are part of the structural.
Structural and practices that impede addressing disparities or that impede access?
That
is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. But we should find a
they're institutionalized in the current sort of status quo. That's what you're trying to get at, right? They're part of the existing
structural impediment.
Right. To structural impediments to equal care.
For example, I just want to throw something out here and see if this is what you're talking about. If someone's on Medicaid, there are very few surgeons.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
That's
and
right.
In order to get more than 3 teeth, if someone wants to get dentures, they have to go through a whole process before they can even have that done.
Right.
Structural impediment
to
equal care.
Equal care.
Now let's keep moving through. We had other hands.
Data standards of collection reporting going to be encapsulated in that? Are you looking at this as a separate?
Well, I thought we were talking about two things. I mean, one is that at the very least, the data ought to be presented using the ACA categories. I mean, that, you know, we ought to be moving in that direction or putting in blanks, and that would include, you know, would include listing sexual orientation for New York. And if we have blanks, we have blanks. But that the Medicaid team.
Right.
Need to be sure that as they're looking at data to decide how to reorganize, they have that kind of breakdown. And then the disparities impact thing is just to say, did they consider the data that was presented, or did they consider the issue of potential disparities in their deliberations? Now, I don't know what the questions look like, but this index that you've got or data providing, you know, between the public health department, public health side of the house and the healthcare delivery side of the house, there's a lot of information. It's sort of like what Rosa was saying. I mean, if there are clumps of, you know, things being dealt with in Medicaid teams, somehow that information coming together to make, you know, make people in those groups look at what is the impact of this on African-American, Hispanic, on Asian, on disabled. Did you consider it at all? We may not get an answer in the first instance, but this is kind of consciousness-raising, awareness-building, and then
I think that's really important to do
as a baseline. It's not a necessarily solution that starts the process.
Okay, so let's keep moving with Ngozi.
Yeah, the issue of maternal and infant outcomes and the cost of that in the Medicaid care system hasn't come up as a mention. Is it being addressed in any other committee, or it's something that I know I've seen it in the other proposals in scattered places, but There is information from the Monroe Plan for Health as an example, which shows that there is a cost-benefit, significant cost-benefit ratio by looking at the quality of the perinatal care system screening and the reorganization of some care delivery for improved quality around that. And they've seen something like for every dollar spent, they save $3 or something like that. So there's a significant data on that already, but I haven't heard it come up, so I'm just questioning where that is being.
Okay, perinatal was in one of the indexes that I showed, and that, I think that's a very reasonable thing for this group to comment on.
So is that...
What's added to the list?
No,
these aren't all work groups.
These
are priorities, right?
Some of them are, but we can try to organize the material around these general categories.
Right. Where is that issue being taken up with the perinatal issue? Because it's not just related to disparities. I mean, it's the whole life course analysis of causes of chronic disease down the road and stuff like that. Is one of the teams dealing with that, or one of the working groups dealing with that at all?
Probably not.
The other MRT
maternal child care, perinatal, is that?
Another set of issues is around workforce.
I mean, before we go off of that, there's so much evidence and research information that is pointing to the need to look at that information, both in terms of quality of outcomes and cost savings of care, that it ought not to be ignored if we're thinking of changing the system, not just for a band-aid approach, but for longevity. You know, of the impact of savings, we have to look at that.
In terms of going back to the point of redesigning Medicaid, given that population is such a huge part of the Medicaid program and the potential impact of actually redesigning, what might redesigning Medicaid for this
population
mean?
Because you're definitely talking about long-term.
We've got it on the list.
But it's not only a disparity
issue.
It's a huge issue.
Right, but we're going to consider it on our agenda as well.
Okay.
I mean, right now we're creating a list. We're not.
No, I just wanted to put it
on the list.
Understand if it's been addressed somewhere else, or where is the best place? And I think in this group where we
are, I think it's appropriate for us to address.
There is a disparities issue related to it, so this group
should
legitimately look at it. And if other groups are working on this, we'll try to figure that out so we can coordinate.
So I had mentioned earlier this morning three areas that haven't been raised yet.
You want me to write them up?
Sure. I did put workforce.
Thank you.
Disparity issues for people who are chemically dependent and for people who are homeless. And then a third category that I had was...
Are we still talking about work groups, or are you just going talking about, you know...
Yeah, it's not work groups, we're just identifying topics.
Areas of focus.
Okay, areas of focus, and the third was...
Homeless.
And the third was HIV detection and preventive sexual health. I don't know. I put those together because I think they do fall in together, and I do think there's some easy, concrete proposals to deal with that.
I'd like to also suggest to pull forward some of the comments from earlier this morning about it being a more consumer-driven patient experience system. Well, I think it's embedded in some of these. I'm not clear that the consumer-driven response,
the health planning response coming from the community,
is prioritized. I want to make sure that the voice of the people is given a priority. So, and I'm struggling a little bit with the both and. Is that, so I'm thinking about the immigrant and linguistic access, is that from whose perspective is that? And is the care modeled in a manner in which they see it as easy access and accessible and meaningful? So I just want to make sure that we're somehow integrating that into all of these.
So somewhere along the line, these are going to each have to be translated into some very specific things we want to have happen.
To be
the most useful, I think, for the process.
Yeah.
So these are good for broad categories. I think people should just think about what actually do you want to change concretely, even if it doesn't cost money, that's kind of the challenge with some of this stuff.
Yeah, and thank you for that word. I think it's an underlying assumption principle that I'd like to have as a value proposition.
Would the issue of community health workers fall into workforce or on the workforce?
Yes, we vote for workforce.
Mm-hmm. we all vote for workforce.
We talked about health planning a lot and wanting to re-engage with communities around health planning and to rethink and revive health planning with a community focus as a strategy for addressing disparities.
I mean, we talked about that this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So I'm
going to crosswalk this. Why wouldn't that be under consumer? Maybe there's some strategies under the consumer-driven piece that we ought to think about.
Okay, you
accept
that?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before
we
find
ourselves
with a list of 100. Yes, exactly.
Again, another
30. But underlying assumption principle, right?
The good thing is 330.
Yeah. Yeah. As opposed to a...
The newly sort of reincarnated Public Health and Health Planning Council.
John Ruggie chairs the planning committee, and they're reviewing the whole CON process in New York, and really going to try to. We're working with the Public Health Committee to try to make some recommendations about that. So there's a stream going in that committee that's very much looking at this issue, but. I think if we took the angle of thinking about, you know, community engagement and health planning as a community engagement strategy or community voice strategy,
and
you know, maybe that's where we can make the most contribution because that may or may not be.
And to look at that opportunity for health planning that they're reimagining, I don't know what Dr. Ruggie's doing, but...
Well, nothing started. It's just starting. He's looking at it. But the idea is, I think, really trying to bring back the notion of more community-driven decision-making. But the voice of the consumer is particularly relevant, it seems to me, to the groups we're concerned with.
And wanting to make sure that there's a focus on disparities there in that health planning process.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a good question. It isn't there yet. Mm-hmm. So this would, maybe we could give this to
that's
them
right.
to help
yeah.
you know, give strategies for that.
Yeah. Other?
Metrics.
Sorry?
Metrics.
Measurements.
Everybody
evaluation.
Has to come up with a metric to measure. No more paper.
Yeah.
So.
Maybe
as a good exercise, we could take a couple of these and drill down on them if we have some time, unless you have more agenda things, just to sort of get a sense of, like, what it means to not to necessarily come out with the recommendations, but just what does it mean to, like, create real actionable items under a couple of these. Otherwise, we could just catch an earlier train.
Let me just make an announcement while we're thinking. There will be two minivans downstairs by 3:30.
To take people to the train station, and I believe one person asked for a cab.
For 3 o'clock. Right.
For 3 o'clock, so that's going to be done.
Thank you.
That put everybody at ease.
Okay. And okay. I noticed that there are 5 different groups, and everything else is an area. Groups are areas of focus and groups, and then we also have a additional areas of focus that we're not going to break off into groups, that we're going to continue to work. And then just to summarize, the staff's going to actually organize all of these things.
Well, we can try to fit those under there, plus the proposals that were on the list in the handout, the existing proposals.
Okay.
So yeah.
Just try to crosswalk.
We can put them, try to organize them under these headings, so people can see the range of ideas that have been proposed to address them.
Okay, great.
And I guess we would offer, if people have specific proposals that they want to email to us, we can.
You'll just put them
there
in
is, these. There is a email address for this committee to communicate with us.
We'll send that out.
We have our own web, you know, we have our own page on the
there
website.
There is a page on the website, and there is an email address for any member of the public to communicate with the committee, but the committee can also use it. We'll scan that email every day and put it in
the category. Okay, so are we... is there an interest in continuing to discuss any of these in more detail?
I could throw out there just to respond to Neil's question. If I were thinking about, for example, the safety net category, I feel like there would be a couple of things that you would want this committee to come up with recommendations for. One would be a definition of the safety net, which feels like that could be very concrete for us to put forward. Another would be ideas regarding funding or sort of distribution of funding of charity care dollars and bad debt charity care. So those are the two concrete things that I feel like that subgroup could talk about. Mm-hmm. Certainly have ideas to immigrant linguistics, but it feels like it makes sense to drill down a little bit on some of these categories.
The third thing would be to try to find the studies that have been done recently on the financial health of various tech groups, mental health providers, whatever. I mean, I know we're involved in Ulster County, and the county mental health system is crumbling, as it is in a number of the upstate counties. So you have a mental health system that's crumbling because the counties don't have any budget to do anything. You kind of like, you have a huge disparities issue on the verge of exploding, and I think we need to bring some attention to those issues. And, you know, I know having sat with Lorraine now 50 times and listening to all of the plight of what's going on in HHC, you know, where are we going to be if HHC has to reduce services and other things like that? I think we need to be able to put that front and center. So I would try to accumulate those reports in addition to that and take a look at them and see where the vulnerabilities are across the system. And that could, you know, include all of the kinds of services that are delivered to vulnerable populations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it would be helpful to consolidate that kind of research on all of these broad topics. Mm-hmm.
Right. And the idea is not to maintain the status quo. I mean, I think we all know that that's not happening. I think the idea is to figure out how to maintain and improve services in a, you know, better coordinated, higher quality way.
One issue we haven't, it's sort of embedded in this, but somebody had raised this, and I haven't really been thinking about it, is that with all of the new people being enrolled in Medicaid, that many of them have never been in Medicaid before, and that the sort of traditional wraparound services or the other services that have been paid for haven't really been looked at in 30 years. And they may still be applicable, but I think it's a question, it's a general question, but it clearly is the group of people that are now uninsured who would be made insured by the health care reform. Is Medicaid going to be able to take care of them? You know, I don't know, maybe that's being considered in the community benefit package or in the way in which it's
another work group
funding
on that.
For
Medicaid. There's another work
group
on basic benefits.
Yeah, I know that. But, I mean, is that...
Yeah.
Well,
you're talking about the...
In that way, I guess it's. I mean, the people that are now taking Medicaid fee-for-service, I mean, the people that are, I don't know, they're uninsured, I guess, but... Or have been in Medicaid fee-for-service going into Medicaid managed care. People that...
Right.
Where what they're used to or not or don't have, now they have something, but are they going to be able to take advantage of it, or is it the right thing? Is it, you know, it's... I don't want to beat it to this if it's being done elsewhere, but it's sort of asking the question in a slightly different way, as opposed to how are we going to increase the volume of Medicaid recipients to meet the need? Is the program going to be able to be fashioned in a way that
people will, you know, will be able to be cared for well, because these are folks, we don't know who they are. We've not worked with them before. I guess that's the way somebody framed the question for me was, which really made me think about it in a different way. I mean, immigrants, say, for example, that hadn't been in, that might, some might be in, and what is the pack, how do you tailor it to a group of people we have not worked with before?
Right. Right.
But some of us have worked.
Yeah, right. But as
working
a state,
with them now.
But as a state, I mean, learning lessons
state,
from.
Sort of.
Well, making it easier for you, too. I mean, are
right.
you being paid for the elements? No.
No.
Well, there you go.
So, that's the point.
Yeah.
How do you frame the Medicaid? Is your question framing the Medicaid to be responsive
right.
to what might be different needs
that's it. Yeah.
Of populations that have historically been
not included. Yeah,
not
been insured.
Included.
Yeah,
not
that's exactly it. It's asking it with a different lens in a way, I think, although it may be the way they're asking the question.
Yeah, and let me just say that there are two other groups, the Payment Reform and Quality Measurement Group, that co-chaired by Dan Sisto and William Strack and Dr. Strack,
mm-hmm.
and there's a basic benefit review that's co-chaired by Dr. Shaw and Frank Franchini.
Okay.
So
mm-hmm.
having said that, those groups also mm-hmm. have on the web a way that you could pose those questions, and I would really strongly recommend that you look at this, because this tells you what the charge is. That's why I wanted to work on the charge, because when we get that settled,
mm-hmm.
that's going to go on the web, and there are going to be other people outside that are not participating
mm-hmm.
that are going to want to, you know, give us some feedback. So this is there. So you could see how they're asking or what they're asking. If there's something you think needs to be addressed, then you should independently from this group submit that.
Okay. I think that raises another point, and that is the million Medicaid-eligible patients in the state, people in the state who are not on Medicaid.
Yes.
Do we have, I mean, it would be really useful to see who those people are. I mean, whether they're, you know, the disproportionate representation of people, what are the reasons why? I mean, those people are always, they're always just beyond our reach in terms of getting them onto Medicaid. So
the people that are currently eligible.
Yeah, there are a million. Yeah, there are those million. And then there's, the Medicaid expansion. Thank you. Bye-bye. And then there's the expanded group. Total Medicaid expansion in New York State is only going to affect less than 100,000 people, right? So that, but those are both, so that's a, you're probably not even thinking about them right now. But there are people who are, yeah.
That's a good point about that 100,000 or so.
Yeah.
Which I think I could be wrong. Please correct me. But those are mostly single adults, and in our, when we looked at who in our system might be eligible, they're male, African American or Hispanic, with alcoholism
mm-hmm.
and substance abuse, drug and or substance abuse, or a combination. That's who they are.
Right. Yeah.
So that's who's currently eligible,
in
you're saying?
No.
No.
Those are,
okay.
when we looked at ACA and the individuals who would be picked up under the new category of individuals,
who under Medicaid.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about individuals who are not citizens.
Right.
When we looked at that profile, and again, they're being served by the public hospital system, they were young African American or Hispanic males with chemical dependency.
Right.
But to come back to the population you raised, I wonder if we want to put that population down
eligible,
not enrolled in Medicaid as a focus, and it's very good that y'all weren't, I guess, Lauren, you didn't have a chance to present on the global cap, because the dirty secret is, of course, that if we got everybody who was enrolled in Medicaid on Medicaid, it would bust through the cap
Friday.
Right. In a very big way, but still, I think it's in our charge to look at that, because that would reflect a disparity.
Is there any benefit in me just telling you the four things that we didn't cover in that two-page list? Because I just kind of crosswalked what Ross said this morning. Okay,
that'd be really helpful.
I think I'm right, but, you know, yell at me. I think one thing we didn't do was we need a high-level policy statement that we can give to the governor on how to operationalize this disparity stuff. Somebody mentioned that this morning. That's still outstanding. So this is a statement from the group that can go to, I guess, the governor at one stage. Secondly, to disaggregate the data. I don't think that we have that up there. That came up this morning. The issue of reimbursement for services that are not being paid for, do you think that's covered in the safety net issue?
No. No.
Okay, so that's pending. The only other one that, believe it or not, I don't think that we talked about, we didn't really specifically talk about the Haitian population, but it was brought up, and then the need to have a Medicaid managed care participant on the group. So those are the things that...
So the Haitian population was brought up, and I don't know... I don't know if that was actually captured in your... proposal around how data is collected.
Right.
It was really around breaking down
the disaggregation.
The disaggregation.
And
I think it fits under the sort of the metrics.
Right.
So I think we've got that. Yeah.
But you mentioned another one that
in the same line as the Haitian one, you mentioned one, and I.
Okay, I did the reimbursement for services that are not being paid.
Put it up there. The reimbursement for services that are not being paid for?
Right.
Do we want that? Well, that's a bit like the Medicaid, the new Medicaid, like what we were talking about.
I mean, that may have come up in the context of Medicaid reimbursement for language services, which I imagine.
I think we can get at that. Identify things that need to be paid for under these categories. There is a separate work group on expanding the benefit package, which things like language should probably go to that group as well.
I'm sorry, what you just wrote, that's not who I was talking about. I was talking about who would be newly eligible under health reform. Those are the single male.
They're currently eligible.
Future eligibility.
Sure. As a result of
the one that Laura.
You're right, I got it. I got it wrong.
That's the million. The first one, there are a million people who are in that bucket. The newly eligible is 100,000.
So then there's a whole other group under that, depending on, and I think we should make a recommendation on this, depending on whether or not the state adopts the basic health program that's optional under health care reform. So I think
that would cover some of these.
So what I understood was it's second. This here is the million people who are presently eligible for Medicaid but not enrolled.
Right. Yeah.
This is the 100,000 or so people who would have access to Medicaid under the expansion in 2014.
Right.
And I'm saying below that is another group of people that include documented immigrants who've been here for 5 years and another class of...
A basic health plan. Yeah, basic health plan.
That would...
The reason we put these up was we're interested in knowing
who they are.
And whether they have, whether there are issues that we should really be focusing on in this population. Basic health plan issue is sort of a different...
Yeah. Right.
Sure.
Because then you could look at everybody and
say, exactly.
Your
basic health plan has certain, parameters, income eligibility.
I would mean what Alyssa was saying. Is just, the reason we got on that was just wanting to know who they are and what, and whether they're disproportionately affected or disproportionately in, or have disparities or experience disparities or inequities. That was the reason.
So the reason I brought up the basic health plan is because, as I gather, the state hasn't made a decision whether or not it's going to adopt the basic health plan. And I think we should be making
a recommendation out of this group, and it probably needs to come out of the immigrant work group to do that, because what that would do is dramatically expand the number of people who would be eligible for care, and what it would also do is shrink the uninsured pool for whom we have to come up with another insurance solution outside of Medicaid.
Yeah. So should we put that as a subset of the immigrant logistics pool?
I downloaded a study that CSS did on the basic health program, and that's actually the largest single group of people who would benefit if the state adopted the packages, documented immigrants who've been in the country for 5 years or more. So obviously that would go to addressing
access
if the state were to choose to take that on.
Yeah. So I put it here sort of as its own
basic
health plan and immigrant access to insurance.
That's
a good point.
We were just talking about this down here. We haven't brought up this issue of the health information exchange, the health exchange, monitoring the exchange around issues having to do with people understanding what their options
right.
are. I mean, it really has a potential real implications on disparities.
Huge set of issues. You could almost go and look at what's about to be implemented from the ACA and pick out issues in that way.
The legislation will be passed. I mean, it will be passed by the next time we meet.
In September, maybe.
Maybe.
Right.
And then that's just a whole other process, because then we have the regs, and then there's influencing, then there's the legislation. I wonder if that's kind of beyond.
It's end disparities.
And obviously,
we could put it on that other, so that at least it's...
I think it's good to put it on here.
Yeah,
it's really big.
It can be huge.
Back to the whole act of
monitoring.
Yeah,
monitoring how it gets rolled out. Yeah, and linkages between people who are going to be in between those two differences.
If we wanted to make recommendations about how quality would be assessed in terms of HEDIS, QAR additions, studies of health, how we would be looking at that, which of these buckets would that fall into?
Metrics.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's on the
right.
Yeah, metrics. Right.
Oh,
here.
Metrics is there.
Can I hang it on the bottom of the TV?
Sure.
Or I can put it right here.
We're pretty much covered.
Do we need to put names against
the things? I have one that I'm just working around in my head. I think it falls into the access bucket, which is the use of the patient portals and social media to increase access. And if you're in a lower socioeconomic group and you don't have access to electronic, then there will be a different health disparity just by not having that. So I think that's in access, and I just didn't want to lose
the
equitable
issue.
Or equitable, thank you.
Oh, equal care.
Equal care.
You just have to call Apple and make sure they...
Right. Structural instead of right.
Give everybody...
Yeah, it's definitely the
care.
Because everybody
can and will
that's
becoming one of the structural impediments
to care.
Yeah, it's right.
And I'm sure it will not be all linguistically sensitive.
Unless they do it through Facebook, where you can switch to your language.
Thank
you. Okay. If we were going to talk about the education of practitioners and their level of
literacy about disparities populations, where would that fall in?
Workforce.
We have a workforce item, I think.
Yeah, that's on the bottom of it.
You put it up there.
I know. Where is it?
It's on the first
one.
Now, I have a question about that. When you're talking about providers, are you also talking about the people who actually work at Medicaid, the caseworkers at Medicaid, the ones who are dealing directly with people coming up to the counter?
Although pretty soon they won't be there anymore.
Really?
Not dealing with them anymore. The local administration of Medicaid is going to be
taking it.
Right?
But I think when we talk about workforce, we could be inclusive in that way.
Yeah, it sounds to me like if we're going to put that in workforce, we probably need to really conceptualize workforce in two different ways, right? One is how do you recruit and train and bring in a new workforce that impacts on disparities, right? But the second is you've got an existing workforce that doesn't do a very good job when a transgender woman comes in to get served, or, you know, some and any of the populations that we're talking about here, and how do you educate that existing workforce to change the way that they respond to it.
So it's new and future and incumbent.
Provider
and entitlement. Both. And it's, yes, and you're right, it's provider and entitlement.
It also includes, you know, a lot of low-wage workers who are losing employment because the health worker system is changing and they need, and they're
right, exactly, yes.
We need a workforce MRT committee.
We need a whole branch of government to deal with this.
Oh, we have one.
We need an MRT department.
On the issue of access, when we roll Medicaid managed care over the years, we have used Maximus, which helps to enroll people in Medicaid managed care. If that was a helpful thing for consumers, is there any discussion to have an enrollment company or whatever?
Broker.
Well, there is the new enrollment system, there's the exchange, there's the continued facilitated enrollment.
Yeah, but how do you educate the consumers?
You mean a consumer education system?
No, is that in the past, Maximus did the education of an
outstanding
to get. Well, it's actually an interesting question, and it came up when around the discussion of elimination of marketing dollars in managed care.
Right.
And certainly I know we voiced a concern about that around people with HIV actually being educated and aware of special needs plans and their ability, and this is going to become even more complicated when you talk about, especially if it becomes mandated, about how do people get educated so they can make an informed choice. And I don't know whether it hasn't even been in existence long enough to collect any data on what's happening in terms of, I think I heard something about some data about a huge variation for people with HIV who were being mandated into managed care just this last year, that I don't remember the exact statistics, but that people who overwhelmingly elected towards a special needs plan, and of course anyone who was auto-assigned couldn't be auto-assigned to a special needs plan, and so de facto there became this disparity between people who were educated and effectuated a choice,
right,
as opposed to a fairly large group of people who, for whatever reason, did not exercise a choice.
Yep. Usually it's because they don't know that they have one.
Well, and so that's where the question that you're raising is, how effective are enrollment brokers when it comes to informing people about
exactly what their choices and opportunities are.
I think it also speaks to a point I made earlier that it's a two-way thing. How do you incentivize the recipients of care to reach out and access the care once it's there? And how do you also incentivize the provider to provide those specialty care? So it's, and I think now we're getting into the second phase of the discussion in terms of what exactly are we going to recommend in terms of change in order to secure those things moving forward. So I think we're getting close to that time because I'm concerned about your train. So I guess, you know, unless there's anyone who hasn't had a chance to say something, who would like to say something at this point, we could go around one more time just to give people an opportunity. Do you have anything else you would like to say? If not, then,
we have
in terms of the public, in terms of the public hearing, maybe another proposal could be that we accept public comment in some formal way, that people can send ideas and that those get distributed to all of us in between the meetings. Because one of the problems with the public hearings where they, I think people had 2 minutes or 3 minutes to like, which doesn't really give people a chance to put down thoughtful ideas. So I really think it would be better to get them in writing and to have a chance to review thoughtful ideas to see if they could, you know, either people are, I got an email a couple hours ago from somebody who's listening in on the meeting who said, you know, made a comment on something we were saying. But I think that people do listen in on the meetings, and also we should be able to sort of look at those comments and see how they might amplify on some of the ideas that we've had internally. But I would prefer that to a public hearing because I think it gives people a chance to be more thoughtful in their responses and for us to be able to read something and digest it.
Are there other people? I mean, I think that point well taken. I think we were looking at a public hearing as being something in addition to the comments that people can submit. And that there was a sentiment expressed that there is a public out there who will not present unless they have a public hearing. That's what we've been. I mean, so we wanted your thoughts on that.
A lot of times, people we want to hear from wouldn't get to a public hearing either. I mean, it's really hard to.
Well, we're doing something with the reentry. They're doing the police training for Albany County, and what we're doing is we've got three forums, and I'm not saying we have to do this, but this is just an idea I'm throwing out. There's three or four forums that are going to be set up where there's anywhere from 10 to 15 people who can come in and tell their stories of their experiences if there were police involvement in a crisis. So instead of, like, looking at the entire community and thinking nobody will come forward to talk, maybe as individuals or organizations or whatever can pinpoint people, ask them questions, say, well, do you have a story to tell? What do you think about this? And try to narrow it down in that way. So then when you do have a public forum, you have people that are coming up that are informed, that do know information, and so that it stays on track with what's being done here.
Mark Kissinger told me that the long-term care work group was doing something, and I didn't get exactly the details, but piggybacking on that, they weren't doing a hearing with a two-minute time limit. They were doing something more that was encouraging, whether it was providers or beneficiaries, to come and make presentations that had more of a dialogue feel to it than everybody just sitting stone faced on a
it's like a town hall meeting.
More like a I'm actually thinking if we did more like a town hall, didn't put some extremely short time limit and gave opportunity for people on the work group to actually ask questions. So instead of just hearing, you know, sort of canned testimony reduced to 2 minutes, there was an opportunity to really get a sense of what people are.
Okay. Organize it around some of the topics that we're considering and offer those for comment and then offer other
Yeah, it could be.
It's not a time limit. I mean, we've all been in these things where people just get at the microphone and they just talk, go ramble on and on about their,
yeah, you know,
their
I
sister
think
and what happened 3 years ago.
I'm not saying have it unmoderated. I'm saying have.
I know.
The idea here is to ensure that everyone who has something to say is able to say it, and that we ensure a forum for that.
Mm-hmm.
There is a concern of travel. You know, there are people, remember, it's the whole state, there are people that perhaps can't make it even to Albany, you know, for whatever reason, but yet they have something they would love to add. So, you know, we're trying to decipher whether we should have a public hearing, where is that going to be, because travel is going to be an issue. If it's in New York City, folks from Buffalo may not be able to make it. So I mean, your thought was well taken. You know, I had not thought of that. Maybe, you know, we should consider having a time period where we request people to give their input in writing, you know, submit to us in writing, whatever concerns or ideas they may have, rather than to do it in a public hearing. Because if we do have a public hearing, we're going to have to put a time frame to it. Because if we don't, it will just, you know, ramble on.
And
it's
going to be
in
Albany and
not really
fair to
people unless you do them all different parts of the state.
Exactly. And then I was going to get to that, which is then the question is Albany, New York City, well, how about Buffalo, and who's going to go? And let's be honest, we're all really bombarded with a lot of stuff and really do this. I mean,
right, it would require the work group travel as well, and, you know.
Yeah. So at the base, we can invite comments, written comments to the committee, and just for benefit of people on the phone and here in the room, there is an email address set up at the health department, which is healthdisparities, all one word, at health.state.ny.us.
Wow.
So I believe that email is posted on our webpage, but we could ask you to get the word out and those on the phone. If you have comments, suggestions for the Health Disparities Work Group.
It's again, it boils down to, though, that not everyone has access to email.
Well,
that's
we can give them an address, too, a mailing address.
You're pointing out that you're really talking about two different audiences. You're talking about the people that, you know, Neil knows who would write something very thoughtful and,
yeah,
and elaborate. And then you're talking about people who are being affected by the issues and really wouldn't exercise voice in that way.
Yes, and you have to, I work. First, I started as an adult home care specialist, okay, so working in assisted living, and now I'm a dual recovery specialist, peer specialist, so I'm on the street. I'm at Potpourri, I'm in Clearview, I'm at CAPS, I'm at all these different places, and these, you know, and I, at one point, myself was not in a position where I had email.
Yeah.
So I think that's very important.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be email. I think we can just
what
on the email
can
address.
We use to get input?
That is why we asked about the public hearing.
But even how would you go about publicizing the public hearing? We could publicize an address and an email address the same way that we would publicize the public hearing.
But maybe all of this could be okay. Maybe Diana could use her team, her impact team, to get feedback, and we could all do the same.
You could do different ways.
You know, in different ways, and it'll still reach, you know, a good proportion of people. You know.
So,
yeah, great idea.
Okay.
Sounds like the suggestion would be that where we have these groups, they should try and come up with their own mechanisms for getting community input into the groups. And at the same time, on the written one, I actually think Susan's suggestion when we were talking about having a hearing or town hall is still good if we, at the very least, gave to the public this list saying, these are the topics that in our first meeting we decided to zero in on. That might provoke a better reaction than just saying, tell us what you want to tell us about health disparities.
Right. Yeah, it definitely would have to have focused in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are able to articulate these issue areas in a way that people would understand in terms of their own care.
Mm-hmm.
And then offer an opportunity for comment.
excuse me, there needs to be some course that gets to do at least some of the data, some of the feedback comparable, because otherwise you can't really know what's true to make them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so the so we have some wrap up. Are you going to do this wrap up? Okay. okay. Next meeting. The next meeting is on September 16th, right? And it's in New York City at 90 Church Street.
90 Church Street from 1 to 4 in the afternoon, right?
90 Church Street, fourth floor conference room.
What time?
1 o'clock till 4 o'clock.
90 Church.
Yeah. 90 Church.
90 Church. 90
Church.
It's the state.
One block.
World Trade Center.
One block north.
Fourth floor.
The week of the 10th anniversary. It should be interesting.
That's
right. Be a lot going on down there.
You think that'll be tough?
I think it'll be fine.
Fine.
Be a lot going on down there. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And, additional meeting dates to be determined. We have one in on October 12th, is that right?
October 12th.
Tentatively October 12th, location to be determined. Buffalo.
No.
Location to be determined. All right. Location to be determined.
There's no travel reimbursement for
travel contract.
We saw
it. I am the graphic disparity.
We put New York City, Albany, New York City, Albany. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. That's a bad day.
Okay. Okay. Anything else that we need to cover right now? You done?
I just want to stress that, I guess, for the next meeting, we really, since it's going to be much shorter, we really have to focus in on the charges and filling in exactly where we're going so that we can get more into the actual nitty-gritty of what we're going to be proposing. Today was, you know, we were all over the place because we had to, because it was, we're just framing and getting in a lot of good ideas. But for the next meeting, it'll be shorter, but right to the point. And we hope to have all the data stuff already in place, hopefully.
Information in between the two.
Right.
And if there's more information that we share, let us know and we'll be distributed.
And you folks will send out the 5 work groups and ask people to sign up if they're interested in one of the 5 and then transmit that back out to the work groups.
And as we'll put together a compilation of data that attempts to get at some of the deconstructing of work groups.
We will get that out to people in advance.
Okay, so I just really want to thank everyone. I think this was a great first meeting. We really discussed a lot of some difficult topics, but we had to discuss them. I knew this was going to be a very good group, and I look forward to our next meeting and that final day that we put forth our proposals. I also want to thank the folks who listened in. I apologize to the 4 members that were trying to participate and couldn't. Hopefully at our next meeting, either you'll be there in person if you're still on the line, or we'll have a better setup. But in either case, I do apologize.
Yeah, likewise, I'd like to thank everybody. I thought this was a great, good, you know, open discussion, lively. I feel like everybody participated well, and certainly, you know, it's just some of the most important stuff that we're doing right now. So I really appreciate people hanging in and doing the work, and look forward to the next meeting and all the work we have to do between now and the next meeting.
Thank you also for your wise leadership.
Your tabs are downstairs. The elevators are in the first floor.